Chapter 7 of Living Ethically. The Results of Actions. Throughout the precious garland, Nagarjuna takes it for granted, as does the whole of the Buddhist tradition, that the law of karma operates not just within our lifetime, but over a series of lives. The advantage of this belief is that it helps to make sense of our observation that some people seem to get away with committing unskillful actions. However, it may be more useful to consider the very real consequences of our actions in this life, regardless of whatever retribution may or may not be waiting for us in the next. What we do and what we experience as a result are directly connected here and now. Not just that actions are matched with just deserts, but that the results of actions are part and parcel of the actions themselves. There is no cosmic policeman handing out speeding tickets. It is our own actions that help create our character. Buddhist ethics are bound up with motivation. It is the intention behind your actions that constitute karma rather than the actions as such. Of course, if the intention expresses itself in action, the karma will be much more powerful than it would be if you simply imagined yourself doing something, skillful or unskillful. At the same time, if you happen to do something accidentally, the relevant karma will pertain to the lack of mindfulness, or perhaps the intoxication, that was responsible for the accident, and this lack of mindfulness is bound up with motivation. Quote, "A short life comes through killing. Much suffering comes through harming. Poor resources through stealing. Enemies through adultery." End quote. Here Nagarjuna speaks about the consequences of specific actions, i.e. those relating to the breaking of the first three of the 10 precepts. But how does the act of intentionally killing shorten one's life? If you create around yourself an atmosphere of anger, hatred and fear, you're likely to attract those people for whom that kind of atmosphere is natural and who are at home in it. Acts of extreme violence require a very powerful charge of ill will. When you kill, you're tuning in to a particular wavelength or to a particular realm of being. You will then tend to find yourself in the same world as other people who are inclined to kill, and of course it's quite likely that you will be the victim of one of them at some point. Alternatively, it may be guilt on account of what you have done that draws you into situations in which you, in your turn, may be harmed and thus punished. This kind of approach, though not a traditional one, has the advantage of reflecting the complexity of the karmic process. One could easily jump to the conclusion that if someone dies young, for example, it's because they killed someone in a previous life. But this does not necessarily follow. There are a number of reasons other than karma for a person's early demise. The fact that actions have consequences does not mean that everything that happens to one is the karmic result of actions one has committed in this or in previous lives. This applies to all the examples of unskillful actions and their consequences given by Nagarjuna. Generally speaking, those who harm living beings will suffer. But do they always suffer in this life? Obviously not, it has to be said. Certainly they suffer no more than do many who are clearly innocent. Likewise, many who steal acquire considerable wealth, especially those who steal by devious means, like crooked financiers. But harming others is always dangerous. You will inevitably create animosity in those you harm, and sooner or later that animosity will be directed against you. It is significant that fierce competition is sometimes referred to as cutthroat competition, and if you cut the throat of your competitor, you must expect that he will try to cut yours. To identify the kind of suffering that must follow an unskillful action, one has only to look at the mentality behind the action. One has to imagine the mental state of one who is bent on harming others to know the kind of suffering they will eventually have to experience. As for stealing, this is the expression of a mind that is never satisfied with what it has. If killing is natural to the beings in hell, stealing is natural to the praetors or hungry ghosts. Praetor-like people are always on the lookout for what they can appropriate. This is no less true of petty thieves than it is of crooked multimillionaires. So driven are they by acquisitiveness that they lose the capacity to appreciate and enjoy what they possess, as well as losing their ability to appreciate people. Human relationships are trampled underfoot in the pursuit of profit. According to Nagarjuna, the result of adultery is that one makes enemies. Adultery is not just a matter of stealing another person's spouse. One is seriously disrupting that person's whole life. It may be one thing to break up a casual sexual relationship, particularly when one is young, but it's quite another to break up a long-standing marriage, especially when there are children. You will probably deeply offend two entire families. In ancient times, an adulterous affair could set off a feud that lasted for generations. If we are to believe Homer, the adultery of Paris with Helen of Troy led to a 10-year war that resulted in the destruction of an ancient city and the loss of thousands of lives. Quote, "These are effects for humans, but prior to all is a bad transmigration." End quote. We have been discussing all these faults with respect to the impact they have in the present life, and it's clear that within the span of one's lifetime, their consequences can be disastrous. But it's worth bearing in mind that for Nagarjuna, as for most Buddhists throughout history, their principal fruit is a bad rebirth. Quote, "Opposite to the well-known fruits of these non-virtues is the arising of effects caused by all the virtues. Desire, hatred, ignorance, and the actions they generate are non-virtues. Non-desire, non-hatred, non-ignorance, and the actions they generate are virtues." End quote. It might seem odd that the beneficial fruits of skillful actions should be couched in negative terms in certain respects. It is almost as though the moral virtues had no character of their own, but consisted simply in not acting unskillfully. The implication is that the negative is, as it were, the original position, and the positive merely the negation of the negative. But these negative terms are not really as negative as they seem. In Sanskrit, the words aloba, advesha, and amoha are formed by adding the negative prefix a to the terms loba, desire, dvesha, hatred, and moha, ignorance. But in each case, the connotation is not negative but positive. We find the same thing in the case of English. Terms like immortal, infinite, and immaculate have a much more positive meaning than their negative form might suggest. Though formally they are negations of other terms, they stand as positive terms in their own right. Many Sanskrit and Pali negative terms work in a similar way. They may be grammatically negative, but the impression they convey is often more positive than a literal English translation is able to communicate. That language appears to falter before these positive qualities or these ideas suggests that they are really beyond conceptual understanding. However, does the fact that language is inadequate mean that we have to start from our experience of the morally negative? It is true that most people are caught up in all sorts of negative mental states and unskillful habits, which, to begin with, have to be given up. But what is going to inspire us to give them up? It will surely be something positive. And how can that positive quality inspire us if it is simply the negation of something negative? There is nothing particularly dharmic about expressing positive qualities by giving negative prefixes to negative terms. It is purely a matter of Indian linguistic and literary convention. Indeed, a positive term, such as the Sanskrit Maitri, metta in Pali, is more truly positive than any of its negatively formed equivalents. Nagarjuna spells out the negative consequence of various unskillful actions of body, speech and mind, and then adds, almost as an afterthought, that the corresponding skillful actions will have correspondingly positive results. He could have presented things in the opposite way, spelling out the positive results of skillful actions and leaving us to work out the negative consequences of unskillful actions for ourselves. That he does not do so is just a matter of Indian linguistic convention. It has nothing to do with the Dharma as such. Putting things negatively may have worked in the past, but in the modern context, it's probably better to think of the moral virtues in more positive and inspiring terms, and to dwell on the positive results of skillful actions, rather than on the negative consequences of unskillful ones. Otherwise, we may give people the impression that the Dharma is just the taking away of something, and its goal a mere absence. This is a common misconception of Buddhism, especially in the West. In the popular imagination, nirvana is often a literal snuffing out, and shunyata, literally a yawning void, a blank emptiness. It is as though one disappeared over the edge of enlightenment into complete nothingness. In view of this understandable but utterly mistaken reading of the Dharma, we should be careful that we do not, as a matter of course, couch its supremely positive ideals in negative terms. Certainly, in English at least, negative terms do not do justice to the sublime union of wisdom and compassion, which is the ultimate goal of spiritual life. If, in teaching the Dharma, we have occasion to tell people what is not good for them to do, we should make sure that we also tell them in the same breath, if possible, what it is good for them to do. Quote, through multitudes of pure wishes, your Buddha land will be purified. Through offering gems to the king of subduers, you will emit infinite light. Therefore, knowing the concordance of actions and their effects, always help beings in fact. Just that will help yourself. End quote. The advice here is simple. We should make sure our actions accord with the effects we want to produce. We know that the best way of helping ourselves is to help others. Of course, we often forget and revert to acting as if we were otherwise. So how do we remind ourselves? The easiest way, perhaps, is to rely on regular contact with spiritual friends, whose advice and example will jog our memory. The Sanskrit term for Buddha land is Buddha Kshetra, and the idea of such a realm is based on the principle that thoughts can give rise to things, and that spiritual aspiration can be a creative force. For instance, if you practice generosity, if you have a generous heart, then under the law of karma, you will be well provided for materially in the future. That is, we live in a certain kind of world, a world with certain general characteristics that give us a certain kind of experience. This world, this particular realm of experience, has been created by our actions. Our collective karma produces the world in which we collectively live. By changing your karma, however, that is, changing your mental state, your volitions or aspirations, you can modify your future environment. From this simple law can be extrapolated the further possibility that if your volitions or aspirations are sufficiently powerful, you will be able to create a whole world of your own, a world better and purer than worlds usually are. Pure Buddha lands feature prominently in the Mahayana scriptures. They are depicted as the ideal environment in which to practice the Dharma and are often described in lavish detail. Each one is produced by a particular Buddha, not with a view to his living in it in solitary splendour, but so that others might be reborn in it and practice the Dharma under his guidance more easily than they could in ordinary impure world. His pure land is the product of his intense and sustained aspiration as a bodhisattva to bring such a world into existence. It is pure in the sense that it is inhabited only by human beings and gods. In it there are no animals, no asuras, no praetors, and no hell beings. Moreover, there's no distinction of gender. One does not need to work. Food and clothing appear spontaneously, and one is free to listen to the Dharma day and night. The idea of the Buddha land or Buddha field need not be taken literally. It is myth, especially when named Buddhas are represented as creating their individual Buddha fields. The principle underlying the myth is that of the power of positive thinking, as it used to be called. If you think positively, if you radiate positive emotion, especially the more refined spiritual emotions, you will have a subtle but perceptible effect on your surroundings. You will create a positive atmosphere, almost like an aura or a magnetic field that influences everyone within its compass. Any powerful personality tends to create around them a world that reflects their character and values. Some people set up an inharmonious world, others one that is intensely fearful or suspicious. Politicians tend to create asura-like worlds of ruthless ambition, while artists tend to create worlds dedicated to beauty and other aesthetic values. In the case of a Buddha, his wisdom and compassion create a gravitational field so strong that it affects all who come within its range. This is his world, his Buddha field. In certain Mahayana sutras, this kind of phenomenon is vastly extended and amplified. They hold that a Buddha can, by sheer power of thought, create a whole ideal realm within which other living beings may be reborn. And there is more than a simple difference of degree between a pure Buddha field and an ordinary impure Buddha field, because the former is a separate ideal environment, distinct from our own world. It has been brought into existence by an individual bodhisattva's unaided efforts, by means of his or her own entirely pure thoughts, aspirations, and vows. An impure Buddha field, by contrast, overlaps with the ordinary world. The Buddha shares it with other beings who have brought that world into existence by virtue of their impure karma. It is like the difference between trying to practice the Dharma in the midst of ordinary city life with all its distractions and difficulties, and doing so in a rural retreat centre. Such a centre is a small, temporary, pure land where spiritually positive external conditions have been deliberately created. Its sole purpose is to enable retreatants to hear and practice the Dharma. According to the Mahayana, the way to ensure rebirth in a pure land is to make a solemn aspiration to be reborn in one, and then to engage in the appropriate spiritual practice. The best known of these pure lands, or pure Buddha fields, is Sukhavati, or abounding in bliss, the pure land of Amitabha, the Buddha of infinite light. This pure land figures prominently in Far Eastern Buddhism, where it's a central feature of the various pure land schools of China and Japan. These schools emphasize the importance of paying homage to Amitabha or chanting his name. This pure land form of Buddhism seems to have arisen out of a widespread sense of spiritual despair. People felt it was no longer possible for them to attain enlightenment in this world where conditions were so unfavourable to the practice of the Dharma. They therefore aspired to be reborn, not in this impure world, but in a completely different world where conditions for practice were ideal. The Vajrayana saw things differently. This world itself is the pure land, could we only see it as such? As you become pure yourself, the world too becomes pure, or rather, you experience it as pure. You are living in the midst of a divine mandala, not just in this defiled old world. You hear all sounds as mantras, see all forms as those of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. Thus the Vajrayana comes back to the general principle underlying the myth of the pure land, namely, that we create our own worlds, whether now or in the future. You can change the realm in which you live by setting up the conditions that will support a positive change in your mental states. In fact, you are creating a world of your own around you all the time. The question is, what sort of world are you creating? And how are you going about creating it? A lot depends upon the kind of people with whom you associate, who will either draw you up to their own level of existence or drag you down. A Buddhist centre, for example, should be a little world, or at least an oasis, of awareness and kindness, quite different from other social environments. When one enters, it should look different, feel different, and be different. Otherwise, it isn't really a Buddhist centre at all. One should feel drawn into a lighter, purer, deeper realm of being. Quote, just as it is explained in medicine that poison can be removed by poison, what contradiction is there in saying that what is injurious in the future can be removed by suffering? It is renowned in great vehicle scriptures that motivation determines practices and that the mind is most important. Hence, how could even suffering not be helpful for one who gives help with an altruistic motivation? If even in ordinary life pain can bring future benefit, what need is there to say that accepting suffering beneficial for one's own and others' happiness will help? This practice is known as the policy of the ancients. If through relinquishing small pleasures there is extensive happiness later, seeing the greater happiness, the resolute should relinquish small pleasures. If such things cannot be borne, then doctors giving distasteful medicines would disappear. It is not reasonable to forsake great pleasure for the small. Sometimes what is thought harmful is regarded as helpful by the wise. General rules and their exceptions are commended in all treatises. We are all prepared in certain circumstances to endure a little pain in order to avoid a greater suffering later on. Yet for the sake of our little mundane pleasures, we deny ourselves the far deeper pleasure, happiness, and fulfillment of the spiritual life. If someone in whom you have absolute trust were to say, "Give me £10 today and I'll give you £100 tomorrow," and you were to refuse the offer, you would in fact be refusing to give up £10 while being perfectly willing to give up £100. It just makes no sense. Similarly, it makes no sense if one would rather forfeit the bliss of nirvana than give up the pleasures of worldly life. All this sounds very logical, but whether we act in accordance with it depends upon our having faith. We need to be deeply convinced of the rewards ultimately in store for us before giving up those right under our nose. A bird in the hand, as they say, is worth two in the bush. Most people's attitude will be, "Give me a clear and compelling experience of the rewards of the spiritual life, and no doubt my interest in mundane pleasures will drop away quite naturally." But in order to enjoy spiritual pleasures, you have to give up worldly pleasures, at least to some extent. And to do this, you need to be resolute and determined. People find it difficult to give up habits like smoking, despite the clear health benefits of doing so. It's going to be much more difficult to give things up for the sake of less tangible benefits. Moreover, the spiritual rewards in store are not really to be compared with mundane rewards. We might have heard of spiritual pleasures, but I suspect that if one was to ask practitioners which were the greatest pleasures they had ever enjoyed, few would mention spiritual ones. They would probably come up with things like sex, drink, food, films, or perhaps music. The pleasures of meditation and the Dharma will seem to most of them rather anemic in comparison. Spiritual pleasures may sometimes be very intense, but they are by nature a lot more subtle than are the pleasures of the senses. The idea of giving up worldly enjoyments for a few moments of meditative rapture every once in a while will seem to most people a poor bargain. Spiritual rewards are subtle and complex, being more a matter of fulfillment, peace, contentment, and freedom than simply a question of pleasure, however rarefied. The argument suggests that pain or discomfort or deprivation is a safe investment, and I'm not convinced that this is really the case. Nor does it express the true Bodhisattva spirit. We are being invited to practice the Dharma not because doing so is intrinsically attractive and inspiring, but because it is a safer investment of our time and energy than any mundane option. It will pay better dividends, and you will get a better return for your money, so to speak. There is something less than elevating, even something ignoble, about such an argument. Whatever the situation might have been in Nagarjuna's time, today it's probably unwise glibly to advise people to give up the trivial, trashy pleasures of the world for the sake of great spiritual pleasures to come, or to assure them that any sacrifice they make now will eventually prove to have been well worth it. To give up small pleasures in the hope of enjoying greater pleasures later on is something of a gamble in any case. Human beings need pleasure just to keep going. If life is devoid of pleasure of any kind, a reaction will surely kick in sooner or later. The denied need will make itself felt, and in the end one is likely to resort to the grosser worldly pleasures rather than to the more refined ones in order to satisfy it. Pleasure is an essential part of human life. Without it, the spiritual life itself becomes so joyless, dull, and arid that the practitioner may eventually lose interest in it altogether. The secret is to make sure that such pleasure is not incompatible with the spiritual life. Pleasurable experience that is skillful, and mundane pleasures can be skillful, has a tonic effect on the system. It's a mistake to imagine that by forcing ourselves to give up all our little pleasures now, we automatically move closer to the day when we will experience the pleasures of the spiritual life in all their glory. This is not necessarily so. It would be like setting off on a week's journey, thinking that if you do not weigh yourself down with food, you'll get to your destination more quickly. Travelling light might serve your purpose for the first day or two, but after that, you'll slow right down and may give up altogether due to lack of nourishment. Small pleasures should be enjoyed quite consciously for the sake of one's overall spiritual progress, not indulged in or snatched at furtively or guiltily. Worldly pleasures, being ultimately unreal and ultimately unsatisfying, are not to be relied on and may be even harmful. But engaging with your friends in innocent recreation that leaves you with more positive energy than you had before can only be beneficial. Milarepa, the 11th century Tibetan poet and hermit, may have given up all worldly pleasures, but his songs are full of the joys of the spiritual life. We have to be honest about how much spiritual joy we actually experience, and must be careful to make up for what may be lacking in that respect with the help of relatively skillful mundane enjoyments. Otherwise, we may experience a strong reaction against the spiritual life itself. On the other hand, we must be quite honest about the importance we give to pleasure, whether we go for refuge to it or are simply making room for it within the larger context of our lives as Buddhists. The human attitude to pleasure and pain is a complex one. It may well be that those who are really struggling with difficulties will come out better and stronger in the end, but not necessarily. Nobody, however philosophical they may be, wants to lose all their money or to have their house burned down, and such calamities may even plunge some people into a prolonged depression. This important caveat aside, Nagarjuna's point is crucial for the spiritual life. The wise person will always be able to turn a very real difficulty into an opportunity. Some people do not need to experience a hard time and may be very inspired and fully committed to the spiritual life without ever experiencing one. But for others, a hard time might be just what they need to bring about a radical change for the better in their life. There are people who object to spiritual practice on the grounds that though it's supposed to free us from suffering, it nonetheless brings us varying degrees of discomfort, both physical and mental. Buddhist lifestyles seem to be all about the giving up of ordinary pleasures and comforts. However, any suffering experienced in the course of spiritual practice is only incidental. It is not the only result, nor even the necessary result, of such a practice. Solitary confinement is regarded by most people as a punishment. Naturally, therefore, they imagine that there is little joy to be had from a solitary retreat. "Wouldn't you go mad with boredom?" they will say. "Surely it's just masochism." But the wise see solitude, when undertaken voluntarily, as a highly beneficial spiritual challenge. It may be difficult, even painful at times. One might experience boredom and even moments of despair, but if one persists, one will access inner resources that will be experienced as deeply enriching and pleasurable. Though sometimes painful, the process will eventually lead to blissful mental states and even to the bliss of liberation. If your basic motivation is to help others, any pain that you experience in the course of making good this aspiration is going to enable you to be helpful in the long run. This can be quite a fruitful way of regarding any difficulties you may experience, especially when you're trying to follow the Bodhisattva path. Suffering is also helpful in a more direct way, in that it helps you to understand the suffering of others. If you haven't suffered much, you are less likely to be able to empathise with those who have. Again, this is not an absolute rule. If you have sufficient imagination, you need little pain of your own in order to empathise deeply with the pain of others. But if you have always enjoyed good health, for example, you might tend to think that people who are often ill and physically frail are making a lot of fuss about nothing and should pull themselves together and stop complaining. Or if you've never smoked, you can be quite unsympathetic towards those who feel the need for a cigarette 20 or 30 times a day. What do you mean you can't give up, you say? All you need's a little willpower. This lack of sympathy based on having too easy a life oneself can extend into quite diverse areas. If you are full of faith, for example, you may be less than understanding towards someone who is racked by spiritual doubts. Or if you are quite content with a celibate life, it can be hard for you to appreciate the difficulties and responsibilities of someone who is married and has a family. But those who have experienced problems in their personal life or who have discovered their own human weaknesses often become more sympathetic to others. Those who can remember their own early difficulties with meditation are often the best teachers of the subject. They certainly will not insist on long sessions of meditation for beginners, sessions that can only result in discomfort and boredom. It is very difficult to enter into another person's experience. It is difficult for a law-abiding citizen to feel sympathy for the convicted criminal, or for the criminal to feel sympathy for the law-abiding citizen who helps to send him to jail. The person who wears the shoe knows where it pinches, as the proverb goes. When it comes to defining compassion, I fall back on Tennyson's phrase, "Some painless sympathy with pain." But the way to that state is generally found through a personal experience of pain, whether in the form of chronic illness, sudden bereavement, or crushing humiliation. Quote, "The limitlessness of the merit of wishing to help limitless realms of sentient beings is like the limitlessness of those beings. These practices that I have explained briefly to you in this way should be as dear to you as your body always is. Those who feel a dearness for the practices have in fact a dearness for their body. If dearness for the body helps it, the practices will do just that. Therefore, pay heed to the practices as you do to yourself. Pay heed to achievement as you do to the practices. Pay heed to wisdom as you do to achievement. Pay heed to the wise as you do to wisdom. Those who have qualms that it would be bad for themselves if they relied on one who has purity, love and intelligence, as well as helpful and appropriate speech, cause their own interests to be destroyed. You should know in brief the qualifications of spiritual guides. If you are taught by those knowing contentment and having compassion and ethics, as well as wisdom that can drive out your afflictive emotions, you should realise what they teach and respect them. You will attain the supreme achievement by following this excellent system. Speak the truth. Speak gently to sentient beings. Be of pleasant nature, compelling. Be politic. Do not wish to defame. Be independent and speak well. Be well disciplined, contained, generous, magnificent, of peaceful mind, not excitable, not procrastinating, not deceitful, but amiable. Be gentle like a full moon. be lustrous like the sun in autumn. Be deep like the ocean. Be firm like Mount Meru. Freed from all defects and adorned with all good qualities, become a sustenance for all sentient beings and become omniscient. These doctrines were not just taught only for monarchs, but were taught with a wish to help other sentient beings as befits them. O King, it would be right for you each day to think about this advice so that you and others may achieve complete and perfect enlightenment. For the sake of enlightenment, aspirants should always apply themselves to ethics, supreme respect for teachers, patience, non-jealousy, non-miserliness, endowment with the wealth of altruism without hope for reward, helping the destitute, remaining with supreme people, leaving the non-supreme, and thoroughly maintaining the doctrine. End quote. If the number of beings is limitless, then the merit accruing from wishing to help that limitless number of beings in limitless worlds is itself limitless. The practices that support this wish should therefore be valued accordingly. In the Indian idiom, they should be as dear to you as your own body, or, as is also said, your own eyes. The argument here is that one should look after one's spiritual practice with the same healthy attachment and daily attention to detail as one looks after one's body. You should feed, nourish, and cherish your practice as you do your body, to keep it alive and thriving. It's not something you can pick up and let drop when you feel like it. It has a life of its own, and it can die of neglect if one allows it to do so. Just as the body finds its highest purpose in acting as a support for spiritual practice, so the spiritual practice itself must have some higher purpose of its own. We should take care of our practice just as we do of our empirical self, especially the physical body. But it is not enough to practice mechanically. We should ask ourselves, am I making any progress? What differences are the practices making? Am I eliminating the unskillful and developing the skillful? It seems that for Nagarjuna, achievement means achievement in meditation, though even this is not enough in itself. You may be radiating friendliness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity, but wisdom ultimately lies beyond these. Meditational achievement is for the sake of attaining wisdom. Surely, once one has attained to wisdom, there can be nothing further to which one need to pay attention. Why then does Nagarjuna go on to advise us to pay heed to the wise as you do to wisdom? If you have wisdom yourself, surely there can be no need to pay heed to the wise. Nagarjuna's point is that in a sense there is no such thing as wisdom. There are only wise individuals. Wisdom is just an abstract term, but if you meet a wise person, you do in fact encounter wisdom. You may fancy that you have developed wisdom, but you can know if you have really done so only by coming into contact with a wise person and through the existential exchange that takes place between you and that particular human embodiment of wisdom. It is folly, as Nagarjuna observes, to have reservations about one's reliance on such a teacher. Wisdom is not an abstraction. It can exist only in living men and women. It has to be embodied. In fact, it is of the nature of wisdom to distinguish between concepts and lived experience. You may think you have it, but the real test is how you fare when you meet a wise teacher and are seen for what you are. No book will ask quite the questions that he or she will ask. No book will see beyond the words you speak. Thus it is clear why we might want to convince ourselves that we are better off not relying on a wise teacher. We are afraid that we shall be seen, and that the fixed view that we hold of ourselves will be questioned. It is possible to start developing a more embodied wisdom by teaching. That will give you a much clearer view of how deep your understanding of the Dharma really goes, especially if those you are teaching are intelligent and self-confident. Ordinary human contact with other members of the spiritual community also has the useful function of challenging us to live out what we know conceptually. It has also the more important function of bringing into consciousness a level of understanding that we had not perhaps known we possessed. More important than realizing you do not know what you thought you knew is realizing that you knew what you did not know you knew. The qualities that Nagarjuna says we should look for in a teacher are relatively modest. They should be contented in the sense of being well-centered. They should be compassionate in the sense of having a disinterested desire to help others. They should be ethically aware, of course. They should have wisdom that can drive out your afflictive emotions, i.e., not necessarily perfect wisdom. We do not need to sit at the feet of a fully realized master. We need human contact with enough embodied wisdom to enable us to overcome our negative mental states. If we were so fortunate as to spend time with someone who was fully enlightened, that would indeed be marvelous. But sustained spiritual friendship of the more ordinary kind will really give us everything we need. Many Westerners have reservations about committing themselves to any cause or any person of a religious nature. There are good reasons for this caution as well as bad ones. One good reason is that a person who is emotionally vulnerable or gullible may be exploited or abused by a charlatan. A bad reason is imagining that by avoiding any kind of commitment we can preserve our spiritual independence. The reliance that Nagarjuna suggests we place on a teacher should not be understood as dependence in the sense of a passive clinging to the teacher for some kind of emotional security. Reliance on a teacher means taking their advice seriously and trusting their wisdom. But in the end, we have to take responsibility for our actions and not expect the teacher to do everything for us. Nagarjuna concludes with a simple, straightforward, and comparatively easy teaching. Wanting to leave the king with something inspiring, and at the same time, well within his capacity to practice, he comes right down to earth. His excellent system begins with speech. For if you are an aspiring bodhisattva, it's probably through speech that you will make your first contact with the beings you want to help. We should say what is truly pleasant, that is, what is actually useful, and not necessarily say what people are going to find agreeable. We should speak with a kindly awareness of the hearer and of how they might feel. We should be aware of what we are saying and whether it is really worth saying. Without being glib, we should try to speak convincingly. We should speak methodically and with discretion, not simply at random. And of course, we should not run others down or defame them. Finally, we should not simply parrot the words of others, but base what we say on personal experience. Next comes a series of basic qualities which are mainly concerned with the stabilization of a positive mental state, with the containment of one's energies, and with keeping one's emotions under control. When you are excited and bubbly, it can feel quite positive, but in fact at such time your energy is loose and unintegrated. Moreover, if your energy is easily aroused, it is more likely to be reactive, so that excitability is not such a positive state as it may seem. Deceitfulness and procrastination make it difficult for others to like us. The final precept offered to the king is that he should have contact with spiritually minded people. Supreme people in this translation. Nagarjuna says we should associate only with those who are going to support our practice of the Dharma and avoid those who might undermine it in any way. For someone who is living in the world, that is obviously a counsel of perfection. But we should maintain contact with spiritual friends and keep these friendships in good repair. When all else fails, it is spiritual friendship that keeps us going through any difficulties, doubts or disappointments we may encounter on the path to unexcelled enlightenment. And that's the end of Living Ethically by Sangharakshita.